Sorry to bring a question. Yes.
On the way down here, one of the women suggested that you were teaching Zen without Buddhism. And so I guess my question is, I'm interested to know if you have words to describe what your technique or method is about.
There really is no technique or method. And I think I mentioned it during the talk, even though the word Zen is in our name, we had to have a name for the new organization. And we stayed with Zen because many things, we have cushions and we have certain schedules that we took over from the old Zen center. I'm not using this word myself. I don't talk about practice either. I've found that quite easily people associate the word practice with practicing something, and the idea that practice makes perfect is there in the background of the mind. So, for lack of a better word, we're at the moment talking about this work. To look into oneself. One works individually with people who want to see me. We do hold workshops. And we still, during the first rounds of a workshop, suggest that people count inhalation and exhalation from 1 to 10, which is a very good way of getting in touch with how unconcentrated one is most of the time. One has something to go by, one has lost the count, or one is up to 60, and one has thought and fantasized. But people don't have to stick with that. Actually, it's better to drop the counting soon. It becomes very easily mechanical. One can count very mechanically in the background and be very involved with a thought or fantasy in the foreground, and the counting goes on very nicely. And this work is to make what is mechanical come to life, which means to become aware how mechanical the mind works, the reactions come out. One hasn't wanted to react this way, and boom, there is the reaction, very mechanical. So dropping the counting to just experience breathing, not follow it, not regulate it, control it, but to wonder what this is that happens every instant of our life. Even if we're not attentive, we're breathing. That's the amazing thing. What is it? Wondering. And then attending. Maybe it lasts as long as one half breath and the mind is off again. Thinking about something completely different, or am I doing well? Am I doing as well as my neighbor who seems so much into it? All the others seem so much further along. To become aware of how this mind operates in comparison. The whole pattern of success and failure, how it either gives us a boost or depresses us. All of this can come into awareness while observing the breathing. Because one is not observing the breathing all the time, all kind of other things go on. And not to talk oneself into what one is doing, but to observe what is actually going on. And then as people sit, attend to the breathing, questions come up to people. Sometimes questions have been in people's minds long before they ever heard of a Zen center or spiritual training. Question, who am I? What is life? Why was I born? What's the meaning of this sort of third condition that the world finds itself. What's the meaning of all this? Why was I born into this? Is there any end to the sorrow that is all over the globe? Questions like this may come up very forcefully, and then why not work on that? Work on a question like this, to try to go with it all the way. What is it is a question that many people work with. What is it, meaning whatever comes up without immediately naming it, reacting to it, pushing it out of the way or clinging to it. What is it? A stomachache, if you don't know it. If you don't call it a stomachache, what is it? Just sort of listen with the inner eye and ear and feeling without any judgment. But it's easy to say without any judgment, because we immediately think, I don't want that. It's wrong. I wish I didn't have it, or is it going to get worse? To subtly become aware of all these subtle resistances, escapes from it. And the attention itself becomes subtle, as the escapes are subtle, or the resistances. Where Buddhism isn't all this, I don't know. I don't know what Buddhism is. Yes.
And yet you have practiced for a long time Buddhism. Could you say something about that? I mean, between first and after.
I came to the Zen Center in Rochester because I had read The Three Pillars. Long before then, I had read many books. I had studied psychology. I was very interested in what is the meaning of life, of my life, which seemed not understood. To give a little background, I grew up in Nazi Germany, half Jewish. The three children were baptized in Protestant church so that we wouldn't be considered Jewish. And yet, that's what we were, in effect. We weren't allowed to wear a uniform which apparently all the other German children wore, and which I would have desired more than anything else to wear. Mm. The black skirt, the white blouse, the black tie, and this beautiful brown leather knot. Instead, I had to wear pink dress or something. It's an incredible thing when among people who all wear a uniform and seem to share this together, you walk around in a pink or green dress. And feeling, sensing, the sense of togetherness that equal dress conveys. Of course, the persecutions, friends disappearing, either escaping from Germany or being sent to concentration camps. Then all the war years with air raids, with the young men disappearing, not coming back practically. One's whole generation of men was wiped out. Boyfriends didn't come back. And then the devastation of the armies moving in, taking the city over. And then escaping from all of that into a peaceful country, coming to this country finally. First we were in Switzerland. One wondered what human beings were doing to each other and why, and whether there was any end to this, any possible end to this incredible sorrow that human beings do to each other. In the name of country, religion, or whatever, always one group against another. It's part of the background. So the lingering question was always, what is the meaning of life? Is there any? Is there any meaning to being born and dying? Leaving psychology, because that was not the answer, even though things were interesting. You could always shed some false ideas. When you study something, you realize what false ideas you've had.
Small offering.
Thank you. Studying, reading on my own, because the department was not offering real insight. We were working more with rats than really studying human beings. Leaving the whole field of psychology behind, going into mythology, finding very, very interesting things in mythology about early religion in which there was no male dominance but female dominance, to see the relativity of all of our conditioning, which had already started by studying anthropology, comparative ethnology, to see that there is nothing absolute in male-female roles except that a woman bears children. And the man inseminates. But other than that, there's almost nothing that is not interchangeable. And with all of this, the male-female problem settled itself for me. It just ceased to be a problem. Coming upon books by Alan Watts, and then reading about Buddhism, Zen, the Three Pillars, going to the center there, and being very impressed with being able to sit. Each workshop had sitting periods, to sit right in the sanctuary, as it were. Right with the figures and the incense. That seemed wonderful. Because in Germany, when you grow up in Germany and you travel, you always visit the churches and the cathedrals and the towns that you go to. It's a must. They're beautiful. And I always wondered what was beyond these red velvet cords. Why couldn't one go there? Why couldn't one go close to an altar or behind it? And here it seemed very, very simple and open, that one could sit right there. I liked it a lot. And attachment grew immediately to that, making a zendon our basement. Having people come and sit with us and being the leader of that group. All of this becoming something more than just sitting and wondering what the meaning of life was, although this is part of the investigation, part of the discovery. How one attaches to things, becomes somebody, almost unbeknownst to oneself. It's interesting, I mentioned it to somebody here, when you start working in a new tradition which is so foreign to a country like this, or to a culture like this, friends ask you what you're doing, and you wonder, how am I ever going to explain what I'm doing? Because you feel a little bit embarrassed or awkward, and then you start explaining. And as you explain to them, you explain to yourself. And the more you explain to the others, the more you explain to yourself, and pretty much as you have others convinced, you have yourself convinced. And you get sort of fixated in something, that you have established, you've built up something. That you're justifying. I can't take too much time with this. Mm-hmm. Could take the whole hour and a quarter. But it is a fact that Philip Kaplow asked me very... well, about 5 years before I left the center, whether I would take over the center sometime if he retired, and I said I would. Because you did what your teacher asked you to, even though it made me gape, is that the right word? Gasp? Not knowing how I would ever be able to do that. Because there were several things I knew I would not, could not possibly do the way in which they were done. And then we were teaching in tandem, alternately. And then when he decided to found a center someplace else, I was asked to take over the center. Until then, I had sort of been doing my own thing with students, becoming aware of all these attachments and ties and separations by having come across the work of Krishnamurti, which was an incomparable clarifying thing to read and to see. But when I was alone in charge there and have no longer this being somebody else's center, even though it was still the Roshi's center, but yet I was alone responsible during that time, I realized that I was influencing people to do what I myself couldn't do anymore, couldn't be identified with anymore, because I saw contribution to separation, to sectarianism, the whole thing. If one looks, one can see for oneself. So then I talked to him and asked him to relieve me of this job. Told him I did not feel as a Buddhist anymore. Neither as a non-Buddhist. This was all, this kind of thing was finished for me. That had to work on my own, the way I saw this work beckoning, which was of utter importance, vitality, necessity, and religious in its fundamental nature, questioning who one is and maybe discovering who one is beyond all categories, words, labels, symbols, beyond all that the human mind has ever put together over thousands and thousands of years. So this is how the new center was started. Yes, you can, you don't have to wait for me to recognize, you can just...
I was at a retreat a few weeks ago, and a woman there attends your center, and she mentioned that there was no Buddha image on the altar. And I'm wondering if you can talk about the kind of, if you have an altar, or the kind of, how that evolved.
We have no altar. That was the first thing that I said I would like to teach in an empty room. And this is what it is. The minds of us folks sitting there is not necessarily empty.
This is a question on behalf of myself and a few other people from Group 4. I feel very joyful listening to you. When I go out into my everyday life and my children begin to whine, and
yes.
How do you keep the practice continual?
That's the most frequent and most serious question that people ask, and the most difficult thing. Because if this doesn't isn't taken, or you don't take anything, but if it doesn't happen in your daily life, what good is it to time and time again confine yourself to the mat?
Yeah.
How do you listen to a whining child? Not just to the whining child, but to yourself wanting that whining to stop. Because you feel either nervous over it, or guilty over it, or just sick over it. So your own feelings and pleasures or displeasures are very much involved in what you want this child to do or not to do. To see that, to see all of that so honestly and simply. Not to kid oneself, I feel so sorry for this child, or to see the whole process that's going on. You may not be able to do anything, but if you can really understand what's going on in you and not fight it, not resist neither these emotions that come up nor the crying, then what is there other than
yeah.
But that's not whining. That's different. But and it may grate on one, then wonder, why is it grating so much on me? It may go very, very deep, and I don't mean excavate your childhood. This is not it. But the tension or the aversion to it, it sits deep. It could very well be that you were never allowed to cry, or your mother said, stop crying, for God's sake, I can't stand it. So now you can't stand your child crying. There are reasons for it, but to just be with all of one's emotions that come up over it, and to listen to this whine without calling it anything, just to listen to it as though it was a new sound that you never heard. It's the same as experiencing your inhalation and exhalation.
I understand.
Yes.
How about, we've heard many things in talks in the Zen groups about being one with what is happening.
Yes.
If you're being one with what is happening, then how does that fit in with the way you see things?
One of the first things that occupied my mind when I heard the teaching at the Zen Center where I was trained, and then talking to people who came to this group in our home, to tell people or to suggest to people to become one with something lacks something. There's something missing in this. Because it ends up in a battle. You're not one, but you're told to be one with it. So you're trying to be something that you don't even know what it is. And then the instruction resounds again, be one. And you're trying to be one, but you're not. And you ignore what it is that is keeping you from being one. Because you resist it, or your willpower is trying to push right through that resistance. So rather than trying to be one, find out what is going on. Resistance. What is resistance? There's so much resistance in us to almost everything, except the things we specifically like. Everything else, there is some resistance. What is that? If you say, I mustn't have any resistance, then willpower comes into being, and that is a very subtly or grossly violent thing, to try to push away what is actually happening to get to something that is imagined. It's a real trip.
But if you experience that oneness, if you actually experience it,
then
not
what is the problem?
Think about it.
Then is there any problem?
I wasn't saying it's a problem. I was asking you, when you experience being one with what is happening, does that fit into the way you see it?
Let me ask you, who, and I'm not trying to make light of what you say, it's a serious question, who is it that experiences the oneness? Is there an experiencer?
That's what I asked.
Because if there is, it's not
right,
oneness.
Right, right.
When there's oneness, there's no one experiencing, it's there. But the experience that comes up very quickly, hey, I'm experiencing oneness. That's the end of it. It's the me again. Mm-hmm. And to see that as a reality. To see it is enough. Mm. And at that moment, does the acknowledging drop again, and one is with what is? To be with something is also, it's a dualistic way of putting it. There's always me being with that. Our language is dualistic.
Yeah.
But does it dominate us to the extent that there's always I am doing this, or is there just this going on? And one must not kid oneself that just because one has heard it so many times, you're one, you're this, you're that, you're one mind, that then one thinks one is, but thinking is not being one. Thinking is thinking, and cutting carrots is cutting carrots. It's two completely different processes. So the question is, does one see the difference between thinking and doing something, or seeing or hearing something? Does that become very clear in the mind, the difference between thinking and hearing? Which is something to examine on the mat. Listening to a sound is there immediately. It must be the fan or the radiator. And then one puts the word aside and listens again. What is that? And one doesn't know. But don't say, I don't know. It may be a conditioned response already. One has heard it so often. Just listening. Not this or that, but just listening.
But when you say, what is that, there's a separation there, right?
Is there?
I'm asking, I don't know. I've been told that.
Be.
I've been told that.
No, there needn't be. The brain asks that question. What is it? And then the question is gone, and it's just listening. And you're asking it because before you said, oh, this is the radiator. That's a word. And you want to find out, what is it really? But you don't have to ask a verbal question in order to be in that state of mind that doesn't know. It's not necessary to verbalize it.
Did you say that your teaching is similar to the teaching of a Sung San here in that he also stresses not knowing. Don't know is a kind of a non-judgmental attitude about life.
I'd like to say something. I've been listening to Tony, and she's saying almost the same thing I say when I explain meditation. That not knowing, not labeling.
I don't know anything about Sung San Im's teaching, so I could not possibly respond to that.
Sounds a lot like.
Maureen made a statement that I have heard before and always found provocative, which is the Dogen's statement that if you don't find a true teacher, it's better not to practice. That's maybe a misquote even, but would you just talk about that? I'm not sure what it means or what I think it means.
Yes, I don't know. How do you find a true teacher? How do you know? And how do you work with a teacher? Maybe this is much more important to ask. You may be very much taken by the personality of the teacher, by the vitality, the looks, the reputation, the books, what you've heard other people say about that teacher. I remember it was always said, go to many different teachers and listen to them, challenge them, make them angry, see if they get angry, was one way suggested. But what do you know about a teacher? How do you work with a teacher? Is a teacher accessible? Can you work on, as it were, an equal level? Not that the teacher's talking down to you or puts you through all kinds of trips. That you have to vow allegiance to the teacher. That you won't go to other teachers. There are all these kind of things. You can develop some sensitivity, what you're required to do to become a student there. I don't even though the word is used in our bylaws, I'm the resident teacher, we had to have some description in there. But I don't consider myself a teacher, and I'm not just saying this because there is truly nothing to teach. And yet, if you come, we'll work together. Mm-hmm. We'll look at something together. If you're open to do it. If you just want to tell me your story, I'll listen. So what was the question? If you don't find the right teacher, it's better that you don't practice. How do you find the right teacher, and what is the right teacher? Maybe there is none.
And why do students study with one teacher for years and years?
I don't know. They do. I don't know. I've read a publication from a fairly new institution on the West Coast, which takes care of people who have left spiritual institutions loaded with guilt feelings about leaving their teacher. Mm. And to just readjust or help these poor people out, there's always supply and demand. It's very, very easy. When you're in this position, it's an incredibly dangerous position to be a student and a teacher, for both. Because students want somebody, and teachers also want somebody. Mm-hmm. It's their mutual existence, this relationship. So one has to question oneself all the time, do I need these students? Do I need to be effective? Do I need to see results? And you work best when you don't need any results at all. You don't put that pressure on the student, because the student feels it, wants to show the teacher that he or she is progressing, doing well, doing better. A lot of times, I've never talked about this, but people say, I feel very bad that I can't show you any results. I've never talked about it. But there's ancient conditioning. Bring mom and dad and the teacher something. And it's not just teacher initiated. I was thinking all these things that one has read recently about what teachers have done to their students. In cybernetics you speak about a coupled system. People do this to each other. And a system itself creates a teacher, or the position of infallibility of a teacher, not questioning a teacher. The hierarchical structure is often inherent in the system, and then one blames the teacher, but it's the whole system which all of us perpetuate and create and perpetuate that is responsible, not just one individual.
There are some types of meditation that are taught that require no teacher.
And one can deceive oneself beautifully, yeah, too. Mm-hmm. You can, with or without teacher, the mind is ever ready to create illusions as long as there's fear.
To me, the essence of, I shouldn't say the essence, but one essence of religion, whatever, label you put upon it is letting go. Letting go. And you've been talking about letting go on the way, I suppose you can say, of letting go of your judgments and your...
How do you let go?
Letting go.
Maybe I shouldn't interrupt you. You finish first.
Mm-hmm. In that book by Mr. Cornfield on the Living Masters, he has a preface where he sums up Buddhist practice by suggesting that you let go of everything. There is now a way of meditation that's being taught by the medical profession. I don't know if you're familiar with Herbert Benson. He's for several years, he's a psychiatrist who's been teaching a way of meditation called the relaxation response, where the individual repeats a word or a phrase to begin the meditation. And then along with it, the usual things that we think about meditation, finding a quiet place, sitting in a relaxed manner, closing the eyes, so on. And he's found in his own practice that if people do this 20 minutes twice a day, that they're capable then of getting off what he calls worry cycles. They let go of their worry cycles, whatever this they may consist of. And to the extent that they let go of them, they are free.
Have you tried it?
Yes, it's marvelous. But I wanted to bring this up in relationship to your distrust of religious terminology and traditions and so on. He wrote this original book years and years ago, and at that time he was working with somebody who was also a psychiatrist, and they were testing people who had gotten interested in TM by giving them medical tests of their reactions, their blood pressure, their pulse, and all these things. And Mr. Benson maintained that it wasn't necessary at all to have any religious context in which to do this kind of meditation. Whereas his colleague, the other psychiatrist, was totally convinced that it was very important to have a teacher, to have a mantra that had some religious significance, or symbolical significance for the individual. So they parted ways. And Mr. Benson then used with his patients only the one word, one. All he ever repeated.
That's a mantra.
One. Mm-hmm. It is. Well, in the intervening years then, in his practice, he came upon, of course he was using these for specific goals to help people, not merely with their mental problems, but with physical problems as well. And over the years, he found that he would encounter individuals, for instance, who would come to him after trying his way of meditation and say, this didn't help me. I'm much worse. This is a kind of voodoo. I'm not going to do this. But when he discovered that if he gave these individuals some little phrase, it didn't matter exactly what it was, except that it had to come from their own religious tradition. If they were Christians, it might be, oh God, have mercy on me, a sinner, or Jesus saves, or something. And he, to his great surprise, with this one person I just mentioned who came and was so rabidly opposed to what had been suggested, he found out the man was a Greek Orthodox, and so they decided that what he would use would be Kyrie eleison. Mm. And that solved the problem. Then the man was able to relinquish whatever he was holding on to.
But who was relinquishing it? Mm-hmm. Who is the one who is trying to drop? Mm-hmm.
Well,
is that, that resolved?
That's a very important question, but from the standpoint of the doctor and the patient, it was highly successful that he was able to free himself of whatever it was that was
for the time being.
For the time being. So I'm prefacing my question with all this asking you. The kind of work that you're doing with individuals, it seems to me, is going to come up against individuals who have such deep-seated emotional complexes and karma and bad experiences from their past, that unless they have some way of somehow letting go of some of that, they're not going to be capable of the kind of work you're recommending.
Well, this work is bringing all this into awareness,
mm-hmm.
and as long as somebody is right in there, wondering and doing it, there's no problem. If a person gives up, then the person gives up and leaves, because it's too hard, too painful. Just depends on what the urgency is for each person, and this is it to. That there be no unconscious mind. It is clear.
But could you speak more about working with resistance then? It sort of got cut off.
How to work with resistance?
Yeah, how
to find out, sit with a resistance, if you have time. I don't have much time.
There's always other resistance.
Yes, yes, and yeah, while you hold the baby. And wonder what it is, and let it talk to you. Let it explain itself to you.
That's the question.
Not explain, but reveal.
That seems
it, to it will. If you just sit there with all your energies gathered in not knowing and wondering about what this resistance is, and you're not coming at it with determination or willpower, it's just a mind that doesn't know and wondering if this is really a problem to you. A deep concern, daily resistance. This is done with resistance, that, and when there's never a wholeheartedness in anything. And just to blame oneself for this is no help at all. It makes things worse.
Just the resistance that comes up in practice when all mm-hmm. this fantasy, whatever is going on in the mind.
What's wrong with fantasy going on in the mind?
Sometimes there's like 10 things going on.
Yes.
And it's a circus.
Yes, it is. and
I've
it has already happened.
I've made the intention to experience my breath.
Yes.
And that's going on too.
Yes.
Then there's 10 other things going on. And then I get confused, I'm like, oh, what should I be doing? Should I follow this one?
Should I
follow
this one?
Should I? You know?
Why do you have this question? Should I do this or this or this? Which means you're naming all of these things to yourself.
Mm.
You're labeling fantasy, you're labeling counting, you're labeling breathing, you're labeling the sounds, and this divides up what is not divided. And then you wonder, which should I attend to first? And you're still thinking of this and this and this in terms of recognizing it. But
it's happening.
It's happening, and it has happened at the instant that you become aware of it. It's already the past. At that instant, there's awareness. But immediately, oh my God, I was so distracted. I wish I was more concentrated. So you're on a new trip, on a new thought train. So we get so involved with the content of our mind. And if there's an instant of awareness, it gets sort of snowed under by reacting to the content of what has come into awareness.
Well, that gets me confused, because I'm wondering how you said to experience the resistance. Another thing that we do is to, you know, gently use your willpower and go, okay, next breath. But you just before.
Why do you need willpower for that? The breath
well,
is there.
A gentle intent. Mm.
The
well,
breath
I can
is
choose,
there.
I can choose where to put my attention. Well, I think I can choose. Sometimes I seem to be not able.
Yeah, wonder about what choice is then. Whether you're directing it, I should be attending to this. Because if there is attention or awareness, there is no choice. Things are just there. The breath is there, and so is...
That was her.
I wasn't blaming you.
It's not easy. It's not an easy matter. It's a matter of starting it freshly. The instant of awareness means whatever you're aware of is already the past. It's a fact. And here, what's going on right now? Where's this breath? Now, you say, wait a minute. You're directing your attention to the breath, but it's there. Why isn't it experienced? Where is the mind? Wanting something, running away from something, expecting something, all of which are thoroughgoing movements of the body-mind, not just the mind alone. When your thoughts run towards something, your whole body is in motion too.
So
even if it's sitting.
So
all there, and then it's this, and then a clicking, that. Yeah. It's no problem. It's all there. But if you think, what should I listen to? Then you begin to make a problem out of it. So become aware that thoughts divide and create problems. And drop it. Is it possible? It's only when it's seen as what it is that it drops on its own, then there is no dropper. Seeing is the dropping.
I got it. I'll drop it.
A question of tradition.
Yes.
It seems that the questions we have in terms of the purpose in life often tend to be very unformed, or you know, there's something that could be aching inside or yearning, but we can't give it form. And it's often in coming in contact with a tradition, a body of literature, or a teacher, something that, like, oh yeah, that's what I meant. It's like we go with that for a while until, you know, we learn and, you know, give it expression, then we may be able to move on to another tradition, another teacher. But it seems like the tradition has a place in giving form, words, direction, or to what for most of us are starting out in life tend to be unformed. And so I'm wondering, you know, can we really do away with tradition? And
well, this is what we try to find out when we left it. But and you can. Yes, it's possible. Coming back to your question, there's a yearning, you say. So there's sort of a yearning, an undefined yearning, and it wants to get form. How do you know that it wants to get form? And if you do go to some traditional, or to any teacher, is that teacher wondering with you, beyond words, what's the root of this yearning? Or is he saying, it's a good thing you came here, and if you do this, and this, and this, and this, right now you're a beginner, do it very faithfully, but in 10 years, or maybe 5 years, you will get someplace with it. It'll help you to find out the source and the goal of your yearning. Then he convinces you that you need this form. Or she. Let's not all blame it on the men. So maybe someone says, yeah, what is this yearning? Do you want to find out? Are you really into it? Do you have a passion for finding out what this yearning is? Let's work on it together. It sounds like I'm advertising myself. I'm not. I'm just saying, watch what happens to you. Are you getting into a whole... Several people have told me when I came to Zen, I wanted to work on who I am, and I had to buy a package deal. This and this and this went with it, and I was told that if I do this, this will all help toward finding out who I am. And there's time in this. Wherever I go, nobody has mentioned it here yet, but usually people say, all right, maybe for the advanced people they don't need the form, but the beginners do.
The beginners don't. The advanced people do. It's very marvelous.
Why do the advanced people need to think?
Because attachment grows. I remember this clearly at the old center. Everybody had protested, we're not attached to this, we're just practicing it freely, but there's no attachment, and it's part of the teaching, don't become attached, and it's all empty. But when I said I was leaving, and I was going to teach in an empty room, and not take anything along, people were thrown in a very great dilemma. Either coming with Tony, but then they would have to leave. As I was crying, literally crying and pleading going on. Why do you do this? Why can't you wait another year or 2 years? Or can't you do? Why do you have to leave it? Or can't you take something along? I want to bring a Jewish couple, a formerly Jewish couple, said we want to bring our child a Buddhist, and we can't go with you. Even both, you know, the wife worked. Yeah. We had a very close relationship, but she still hasn't been able to even set foot into the center because of this few years, this tremendous attachment now. First it was Judaism, now it's Buddhism.
Are you saying there's no place for teacher-student relationship in a religious practice?
I explain the relationship as I see it, but not as someone with an aura or skillful means. On a basis of friendship, two human beings coming together. Someone points something out, people point things out to me too, and I look. I don't say, wait a minute, who are you talking to? I'm your teacher. I said, sir. I listen, and very often a good talk comes out of it. It's material for a new talk. Somebody brought something up I hadn't looked at. Or hadn't thought through thoroughly, or seen through so thoroughly. Yes, there's, of course, we're related to each other. Did you want to ask?
What's the difference between being a therapist?
Are you a therapist?
No.
I've talked to a number of therapists, and I've studied psychology. There's a psychoanalyst in my family. I was in psychoanalysis myself long ago for a year. I've nowhere found anywhere that a psychiatrist or therapist questions the self. It's taken for granted. It needs to be readjusted, enhanced, helped. There is no questioning of that at all. It's an absurdity to a psychiatrist to question the self. You need a strong self. And this work questions the self.
Was it your experience when you were studying all those years, the external forms, the trappings, the accoutrements, the images, the incense, the robes, whatever, was it always for you a way of creating separation and alienation?
I loved
it. No benefits?
I loved it. When I was first given this roxo at the center where I was, you were given this roxo after getting through a number of koans. And the robe that you put on, you have to watch it very, very simply. And I'm not speaking for anybody else. Everybody has to watch it for him or herself. This roxo that I was given had written inside of it, wondrous is the robe of the Buddha, a treasure beyond form and emptiness. I will wear it for the sake of all sentient beings. So you already have this given to you, that you're wearing it for the sake of all sentient beings. This is already put into your mind. Will you then still look and see how proud you are and how you feel really a little bit different from everybody else because you have it?
Was it never, was there never also a way in which it was used in a beneficial way, a source of courage or inspiration?
You can talk yourself into that. You can talk yourself into that. And other people, some people said they were always devastated when there was another person appearing with a raksu. It meant, again, I haven't made it, somebody else has made it. Other people said, it's very inspiring to me that somebody is making it. But you see the whole thing? Of course, this is not used. Different centers use it differently, but... What was your last question? Was there ever any inspiration to it?
Well, inspiration,
yes.
I understand the pride and the glory that you're talking about, but I'm wondering if...
It's more subtle than that.
It's not also ever a source of something that you remain appreciative of, even though it may be at this time something that you choose to discard.
Oh, you can imagine what you appreciate and what it is doing for you, but I think it was good to fold it up and put it away. Because in truth we are nobody. We're nothing. And I don't mean this in any derogatory or negativistic way. It's that is your oneness when you're nobody. And not you are nobody. I think I mentioned this in the talk. This can be a new idea, a new identity. I'm nobody.
If one is not there, then one is not capable of being insulted or injured. I happen to be going to some psychotherapy right now and also working in the other consciousness, and it's very wing-wang.
Working in the other consciousness?
Well, the consciousness of meditation consciousness where you really are not there and not... There is no injury, there is no insult, and on the other hand, dealing with a psychotherapist who says, well, you must have a self and you must be careful that people around you are not taking advantage.
Yes.
Is there a balance?
Yes, let's look carefully at this meditation consciousness in which there is no self. This may be a questionable thing. One can, the mind can trap itself into a certain numbness to hurt. When there is no self, no one will exploit you. You will, when somebody does exploit you, say, no, no thank you. That's always the question, if there's no self, will I become a doormat? Or so. But these are all, this is an idea. But you can meditate yourself into a state which you may think is a state of selflessness, but there is still someone there who has that state. Is there? Who is in that state? Or is it just an oblivion, a certain indifference? We'd have to look at it closer, what that state really is. And the other one was, when you said you get...
To the psychotherapist, and the psychotherapist says, there's a disequity here and you shouldn't put up with it. Or
is he telling you that, or are you telling him that you have a hard time putting up with it?
Usually it's coming from him or her in this case. It is a suggestion. Well, she's like, wait a minute, she'll say, isn't this and this happening? Therapists are much more willing to comment on what's going on in your life these days.
Telling you what is happening to you. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Can you start working with this and say, wait a minute, let me look. I didn't say that. I don't feel that way. I mean, don't be talked into some mind state that you may not even have, that may not even be there.
I think I have to be more careful.
Yes. That goes for all of us, all the time.
You made a distinction between...
She has been raising her hands.
Excuse me, there's someone who has... we'll come back to you. Sorry.
I'm wondering how you, Tony, live with the trappings of being a heretic, a rebel, someone who has been labeled in that way.
Do I sound like a rebel? I may. I may sound like that to you, or like a heretic. I don't feel that way. Because it's very clear that as long as you rebel against something, you have not done with it. You're carrying that with you and you rebel against it. If there's a dropping of something, there's no need to rebel. How one lives with this? If you start thinking about it, what will people think about me? Or then, like any time you worry what people think about you, you worry. But there are things that you do where there is no choice. You don't choose to do this because it'll be pleasanter or unpleasant. You just cannot do otherwise. And then the consequences are faced as they come up. There will always be rumors going around about when I found that out. No matter what you do, you will be misunderstood by some people. And this will be spread about, and by the time it goes from one to the other, it gets always changed a little bit. So it's. But how do you live with it? It's such a good question. How do you live? How does one live oneself? Is there this seeing and the filtering out of everything extra going on from moment to moment? Then you have nothing to worry about. Then you have nothing to fear. For one thing, then you don't see people as your adversaries, as having it in for you, you know, the state of paranoia that's all too familiar. You see it, and you drop it, because you've seen it. And you understand how people feel who want to have their thing and want to keep it intact. It's threatening, it's painful. You understand that.
But Tony, it's not always just threatening and painful. Maybe for some people it's still a helpful, supportive, not in a crutch-like way, but there are people that maybe are very supported by quote-unquote the patriarchal system or living in a Zen center or using an altar. I mean, I have a feeling from you sometimes that it's you feel like your way is the only way that's unhindered and free, and maybe there are people that do find freedom and real support within Zen centers in this country.
I only go to other Zen centers when I'm repeatedly invited.
Well,
not just once.
What does that mean?
I'm not going someplace to tell people about our way.
Well, yeah.
It's when people ask me to come and ask me questions and I have to answer them. But I'm not touching people's ways. If somebody comes to me and says, look, I want to discuss this with you, then I'll discuss it. But I'm not going out telling people you're attached and you're clinging and you're not. I don't do this. It's fine. What people need to do, I don't interfere with. It's only when somebody asks me what I think or see about it, then I do it as best as I can. I didn't mean to be aggressive. Did that strike you like that? Or?
No, just, it feels like there's, when I listen to you talk about meditation, I feel very at one with you, you know, feel like I sit very much the same way, you know, and I use my mind the same way, asking what is this, what is it, and yet maybe my way of, I feel like I get a lot of support, and you probably do too, from the friends that sit with you, and there's just, I feel somewhat that there's some, I hope I can put it in the words, but it doesn't need to be a problem for just talking about you and I, just because I'm just talking with you. But that doesn't need to be any problem at all if one person finds support in one way and one another way, or some people don't need any support at all and sit alone in an apartment in Manhattan, and they're just as clear as anyone else. But I just still feel there's something where there's a dichotomy. And I don't know, have no idea whether it's coming from me or you, it might be a little bit from each of us, but I feel something, there's still a taste of resentment or unfinished business, you know. I don't know. And it's not a criticism at all, I'm just sharing that, you know.
It may seem to be this way because people who are
involved with something, all of a sudden find somebody like this in their midst and hear things that they usually don't hear. But if I were here, if I were you, I would question a lot of things. But that would be my business. I'm not saying that you should. You either do it or you don't, or maybe you don't need to. I don't know.
Could you tell me why you call your place Zen Center?
Yes. When we incorporate, and we had to incorporate because as soon as you deal with money, you have to be incorporated, and then you have to have a name. And we asked people to come up with names, and there were some 50 names suggested. And we wondered whether to have the word Zen in there or not. Really seriously, not rebelliously or flippantly. We really wondered what would be the most descriptive name of what we were doing. And since we were still using certain forms which we had learned from the Zen tradition, namely retreats, even though they have changed a lot, retreats, the personal meeting with the teacher during retreat, the talk during the retreat, all kinds of features, koans are being used if people want to work on koans. We felt that it, in all fairness, to not call this a Zen center, where all of this was used, well, it should get credit, if you want to put it this way. We were always open for a new word, which hasn't come up yet. It's descriptive. It does not mean affiliated with organized religion. I don't know whether this word is properly chosen. It's descriptive.
I made a distinction between the type of work you do in a psychiatrist. Psychiatrist, you know, doesn't examine the self, so you do the work of examining the self. Again, not going back to the question of tradition, I see tradition or discipline or whatever is a way of helping people see things, see something maybe they wouldn't take a look at. I guess in the Buddhist tradition, because you take a look at those same things that coming out of the Buddhist tradition, the self, what is there, what is the self, is there anything that is there. So in essence, in terms of teaching people where to look, what to look, how to ask, you know, it's sort of in the same, I see it in the same tradition, in terms of what's added on, in terms of giving form to that, may be a question, but in terms, you're pointing to the same thing, in terms of, hey, look at this, you know, question that.
Actually, it's not just the Buddhist tradition, you could say the Eastern religions have, by and large, been the questioning religions, the religions of doubt, whereas the Western religions, by and large, have been the religions of faith, belief. And yet, that was really amazing for me to find that I had, by having read Zen literature, I had thought that was free of all of that, and to find so much what I hadn't thought was part of Zen, to find it seriously taught and practiced, was interesting and amazing to me. I don't know how it is at this center, but there's faith in the Buddha, faith in the teaching is expressed, refuge taken, and not this, well, it's sort of a dual thing running side by side. It was said in the particular patriarchal succession of teachers, wasn't just the teacher I worked with, but his teacher, and his teacher had said that in bowing to Buddhas you establish a responsive communion with Buddhas and other Buddha lands. I was amazed when I heard that. So there's a mixture. But coming back to your point, questioning is not just the Buddhist tradition, it's also the Hindu tradition, Taoist tradition. The doubt, not to take anything on faith, but to find out for oneself alone.
Tony, what about the idea in daily life and sitting practice, when we're very busy, the idea of being quiet enough and not just sitting on a sofa thinking. If we're questioning, you know, how do I know I'm just not, you know, my rational mind isn't turning stuff around instead of in being in a meditative, open space, able to listen, totally listen.
Your question is, how am I when my mind is turning over at the same time to be in an open listening space? You're not. You're not. When the mind is turning over, and why is it turning over? Is it just going over past experiences? There's something more in it than that. Maybe one was wronged, or one wants to have something back, wants to get something. You can probe into it a little bit more deeply. All of that is no space at all. It's total self-enclosure in one's past and future. I'm not judging it. It is so. And the narrowness of space is palpable, is visible, when one has just been sitting and there was no enclosure. And then all of a sudden the thought comes up, hey, why did he do that to me? And zoom, the space is gone. It's tight, and anger comes up. So at this moment, anger comes up. In one of the last retreats, one woman came and she says, I wouldn't believe it, and you wouldn't believe it. An incident which happened 15 years ago crossed my mind. And all that this mind was doing was trying to get a revenge for this incident 15 years ago. I was consumed with it. I was nowheres here. But then suddenly she came to and saw it. So how does one, if there is an inkling of awareness that is going on, an instant of awareness, then what? It's very crucial what happens at that moment. Do you think, I shouldn't be angry, I've taken the precept against anger? Then you're off to something else. Are you just listening to this, like you listen to the rain? Mm-hmm. You can do that. That the anger and the listening are not separate by one iota of resistance or judgment. There's just that. And then, what is anger? Find out.
I guess it's easier for me to do that when I'm sitting in longer retreats. But
then if
life,
you're in your office or
I'm
at home.
Only, you know, an hour
yes.
or 2 hours a day.
Yes.
The stuff from daily life
yes.
kind of turns
yes.
over.
So yes.
in long retreats, I absolutely...
Yes, so your first question was, how do we take this into our
daily life?
Don't take it, but can it
right.
reemerge?
Right.
Yeah, of course it can. But why doesn't it? If this bugs you, why doesn't it? Why does it go? Where does it go to? Where is it right now? At this moment, you're already attending again. Because you're grabbed by this question, where is attention? During my daily life, where I'm from inattention to inattention. And here now you start wondering about this. And you'll be more attentive just because of the power of this wondering about it. Wanting to find out how one lives. Because while we're inattentive, we do all the stupid things that we do. And then we have to eat that and wipe that up. It just goes on endlessly. So to the extent that you want to find out how you live, how a human being lives, not just me, but it's not just me, it's not personal alone. It goes much deeper, much broader. To that extent, attention will be there.
In our practice, the statement has been made, when we realize our true nature, we're not doing it just for ourselves, but we vow to save all sentient beings. Does this kind of feeling get into the kind of meditation you're doing? Or work? That you're not doing it for yourself, that you're not questioning and wondering just for yourself?
One starts that way, doesn't one?
Mm-hmm.
We all start that way, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
And at the moment, you're really honestly, if you look honestly, wrapped up in your own misery and trying to see if it can come to order or stop. Helping all sentient beings is a thought, isn't it?
But
it's a nice, inspiring
some people.
Don't talk about some people.
Oh, okay.
Because you don't know about some people.
Yeah, all right.
They are not so different from ourselves. It's an inspiring thought, and one likes to hear it. We do love inspiration because we feel so down most of the time, and then an inspiring thought lifts us up like almost any high or an inspiring concept of doing this. And you don't have to face your selfishness if you can talk yourself into everything I do, I'm doing for the others. Then you can revel in the boost the thought gives you, and you don't have to face selfishness, which is hard to face, it's painful. And yet if you do face selfishness, you don't have to label it that way.
Mm.
It makes it hard to face it if you've already labeled it. The conditioning mechanisms are very strong, so don't label, but look and be with it. It's a dualistic way of putting it. Be that. If that opens up, you realize you're not different from all sentient beings. That's a fact. And whatever you do affects everybody. There's no getting around it, for better or worse. It is so. If you see it for yourself, you don't have to vow it. You walk very, who said, very carefully. One has to be very careful. Really careful.
Not to slip me.
We slip.
Do you find in your practice that moments arise when you feel this tremendous compassion and love for other people welling up?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, and that is not, that has nothing to do with my, it's not mine. Compassion does not belong to anybody. And where it comes from, it doesn't even come from someplace. Either it's there or it isn't there. And it is not exclusive or divisive. And it doesn't have the thought me in it.
Excuse me, I think we've got to stop and
let
other people come in.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.